The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
C'est que le cinéma était encore tout jeune, lui aussi. À peine 30 ans depuis que Maxime Gorky avait assisté à la première projection des Frères Lumière en Russie et essayé cette chose impossible, d'écrire le cinéma à des gens qui n'ont jamais vu le cinéma. Extrait de cet article publié le 4 juillet 1896.
Здравствуйте, comrades. It's another Loose Cannons podcast. Coming at you.
Somebody learn some Russian for the intro.
Coming at you.
Check that shit.
Communism
out.
Month.
With, should have done this whole intro in Russian, man.
Yeah. The last Bolshevik.
For all those Russian listeners that we have.
How was my pronunciation, Ilya?
Pretty good. Здравствуйте. Right.
My great grandmother is Russian. So.
Well,
anyways,
the roots are still there.
Before we join in a unified communist discussion, sharing the wealth on one movie, let's discuss different movies in a more capitalist segment called Heralds and Denouncements.
That's for all the communist, real communist fans out there.
Real communist hours, who up? Since it's communist month, I joined my comrades in watching. Or I guess rather rewatching *Inglourious Bastards*, and I'll be the next in the long line of people on this podcast to herald it. Once again, I think it's a good time. There are some like small gripes that I have with it, like Brad Pitt being a little bit grating at times. Sorry.
Take
sorry.
Off the ing, then I agree. He's a little bit great at times.
I don't know. Something about his performance sticks out to me, like in
yes, it's because he's really good.
You're gonna make me say Brad Pitt talking Italian again.
His arrivederci.
Do it again.
I think
arrivederci. But I don't know.
Makes me laugh every fucking time.
I think Quentin Tarantino's on a really good streak of lead actors in his movies with Brad Pitt,
Jamie Foxx,
and Samuel L. Jackson being the only thing that I really like about The Hateful Eight.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. But besides that, it's a great movie. Hitler gets shot a bunch in it, which is hilarious to me. I had forgotten like the amount that he got shot in it because I hadn't seen it since 2009. But rewatching it, I was just like, "Wow, they really like they shot him a lot." It's like he got shot. He gets shot a bunch, and then it just cuts to Eli Roth's face, just like. Angrily, like still machine gunning him, and then it cuts to him shooting him even more, and then he explodes. And I was like, "Wow, they were like I didn't remember the just how long that bit went on, of them just shooting him and all of the other people in the theater." But yeah, there were like other small things that I liked about it that sort of like ran throughout the movie that I didn't remember, like the character of Zoller, like. Being a complete heel from the word go. I for some reason remembered him not being a complete heel when he first showed up, like him kind of being sympathetic, but like on this rewatching I was like, oh yeah, no, he's the worst, like immediately. Yeah,
he's the nice guy Nazi.
Because you're a woker now?
Like, I guess so. Yeah, it definitely is. Like, I was like, oh my god, like, all of the stuff with Shoshana, like, throwing shade at the, like, the French translator, to the, like, you know, psychic shade she throws, where she's like, yeah, you're getting fucked by Goebbels in the ass every night, you fucking conspirator, or whatever, you collaborator. Like, you know, just all that stuff I did not pick up on the first time I saw it, and I was like, wow, this is really good, and, like, especially relevant in 2017 now. I was like, goddamn, like, he was really ahead of all of us on this one. He scooped us big time.
Yeah. But since you mentioned Zoller, Daniel Brühl, who's the main star of Goodbye Lenin, I think that probably is his finest performance of tracing a thorough line from Nazism to nice guy isms. So, like, the nice people who are nice to women because they expect them to have sex with them.
Yeah. Hashtag Nazi all men.
But yeah, there were a lot of other little touches that I can't quite put my finger on right now, but that I just really enjoyed about this movie the second time around. So, thumbs up, recommend it. It's on Netflix. Go watch it.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and herald the first 45 minutes of Apocalypse Now and get a chance to watch the rest of it, so there's a chance it falls off. But
it does.
Unless it does, it's going to be one of my favorite movies ever. Like, I'm really excited about how much I like this movie. It's way funnier than I ever picked up on. Like, from almost, like, right away, it's just, like, very strange and ridiculous. Like, one of the very first scenes is Martin Sheen, like, getting his, his mission from, like, these generals to go hunt down Marlon Brando. And,
Colonel Kurtz.
The general's like, he was one of our best guys, but lately his methods have become unsound. And he, like, hands him a thing, and, like, just the way the whole scene is pitched, it's like, oh, here's, like, a bunch of butchers going, this guy is too much butchering. Like, we don't like this kind of butchering. This is the bad kind of way to slaughter a population. And
really
just,
obvious,
like, how ridiculous they all seem is, like, super, super funny. Like, I was laughing really hard. Like, Harrison Ford plays, like, this nerdy officer in it who's, like, all clearing his throat the whole time. And I was like, oh, this is so weird. This is, like, Kubrick level, like, just, like, very strange. Like, it'd be somewhat easy to, like, read the scene straight, but, like, seems very clear to me that, like, Coppola thinks, like, this whole thing is very ridiculous. And just the whole movie is like that. Like, there's so many shots that I'm just like, how in the world did they even, like, manage this? It's like people walking and talking, and then, like, behind them, like, a building's on fire, and then behind that there's, like, a helicopter, and then behind that there's, like, another helicopter going in a different direction. And I'm like, how did they, like, time all this? It's just, like, outrageous. And Fire looks really good. I was telling Ruben about that earlier. Like, the 70s was the perfect time for Fire on screen. That one movie, Sorcerer, like, a huge
a lot of fire in that,
like,
one.
Oil derrick that's on fire the whole movie, and I'm like, man, I could just stare at pictures of this oil derrick on fire forever. And Apocalypse Now has a lot of other stuff that's also on fire and looks really unsettling and cool.
The Mirror had that basically house on fire, right?
Oh yeah, it's true.
It was also a 70s movie.
Yeah.
So, good time for Fire.
Yep, I'm really excited to watch the rest of it. The only reason I didn't is that I was watching it while waiting for Haley to get back from the airport for her trip, and she got back, and I was so excited about the movie, I was like, oh no, we gotta start this over and watch it together very soon. So I'll chime back in once we do that.
Yeah.
You didn't watch that one on acid, though, right?
Well, I was coming down still. It was yesterday.
Okay. Okay, yep. Cool.
Which is also a perfect time for that, because at first, one of the ways they described the movie is like, oh, it's a hallucinatory take on Vietnam. And I was like, because I hadn't seen it since I was 16, I was like, oh, that sounds like something a dumb critic would say if they had never taken acid. But then as I was watching it, I was like, oh, no, that's actually true. Like, yeah. The very first shot is jungle trees from really far away, like in slow motion, and the way that they're swaying looks exactly the way that like plants look when you're tripping, where like you see these minute movements that you don't really see when you're like normal, and it looks like very weird. And I was like, oh, he really intentionally did this. And then like the joke, I guess, of it is that it's actually just wind blowing them, because like a helicopter lands in slow motion at the very end of the shot. But I was like, well, I'm in for this movie from
first. The Doors are playing.
Oh yeah, that part I don't like, but
yeah, I was about to say,
but speaking of drug culture, yeah,
mm-hmm. It does fit,
right? Well, actually, I can segue pretty nicely into what my thing is that I watched the first 45 minutes of Doctor Strangelove.
Nice.
And I have not laughed once, or maybe exactly once at this movie. And I personally think that people who think that this is like a comedy are fucking psychos. Like, I don't know, like, what is wrong with them? Or if Kubrick is playing this up as a comedy, like the weird thing is, it's like the way people are acting are like they're in a comedy, and the way like the movie is generally pitched in this like pretty like frenetic way of talking, and things kind of happening for silly or stupid reasons, except that the things that are happening are really awful. And like, I guess just picturing the idea of being now close to a situation where something like this might happen for similarly stupid reasons with people of similarly like frenetic and unpredictable character at the helm of it all, kind of makes it all really, really dark. Yeah, I mean, like, really, so far, because I haven't really gotten to Peter Sellers playing Dr. Strangelove, so far all the acting is really great. Like, especially Sterling Hayden is really, really scary as hell in this movie. But, like, he's not really like funny scary. He's just really scary. Like, it's really strange. Movie looks really great, unsurprisingly, I guess, for a Kubrick movie. But it's like the sets are really cool. The lighting is really, really interesting. I mean, I feel like it doesn't take like too much of an expressionist, like an obvious expressionist angle, but like the mood and so on really make it feel that way, and obviously the black and white kind of make it feel that way. But yeah, so far it's really trippy, I'm curious to see whether I'll like end up like enjoying it all, or realizing it was really the comedy all the way through, and I was just too dumb to pick up on it, like all those genius critics that have written about this movie. So
we all had our fluoride before this podcast, speaking of, right?
Yep.
Was that a sure herald? Have.
Purity of essence.
By the way?
I would say yes. I would say so far yes.
Heralding the first 45 minutes. The two movies I watched are slightly above and below my normal cutoff for Denouncement and Herald, but I'll go ahead and herald Meek's cutoff anyway, because I feel like if I saw it in the theaters, it would definitely be a herald, because the main thing that I like about it is that it's a super good looking movie, which is always enhanced in the theater. And the main thing that I didn't like about it was I was kind of bored for the first 30 minutes, which is always more tolerable in the movie theater as well. And I think it's Kelly Reichardt's best looking movie, and probably also her most obtuse, which means probably deserves a rewatch at some point, hopefully in the theater.
Yeah. That definitely shifted it for me. It went from a movie that I liked to a movie that I loved from watching it in the theater. I really like how boring it is. I was like, ah, this is the best kind of being bored. Like, just watch these people wash plates for half an hour. It's great.
Good old plate washing.
Yep. Apparently, I don't notice or care about fake beards, though, because I didn't even register with me until every single review on Letterboxd complained about Steve Greenwood's fake beard.
Yeah, I didn't really care about it either.
Yet you mentioned it in your review.
I noticed it more the second time. The first time I watched it, I didn't notice it at all. But then
some real beard sticklers on Letterboxd.
Well, yep. Your review is from the first time you watched the movie.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Huh. I guess I remember wrong, but I'll have to go back and reread my reviews.
Yeah.
remember what I wrote.
I really enjoyed his performance, though. Beard and all, yeah. I guess. He does a really good job of being a very uncomfortable type of man. It's like... Yeah. I don't know. He's giving this speech about how men are made of destruction and women are made of chaos. And I'm like, whoa.
Does he have
can they just, like, murder this guy to get him out of the way? Because, like, nothing's good is going to come from having him around.
Jesus. Some people see beauty in men and women. I see only chaos and death.
Don't remember whose pick this was. Is it Basil's?
C'est moi.
Yeah.
All right. Basil.
Yeah. The Last Bolshevik. So this movie is sort of a look back after the end of the USSR, filtered through the kind of like attempt to reestablish Alexander Medvedev as a really important director for the USSR, and as kind of the only of the major directors, I think, who like basically lived through the whole thing. You know, he was in the war in 1917 and part of the revolution, then became director for the USSR after that, and lived to 1989, and was also a friend of Chris Marker's, so Chris Marker tries to kind of trace his filmography and also at the same time create a kind of historiography of the USSR and the ways in which it didn't live up to the expectations of communism or failed. And it seems to me, sort of knowing a little bit about Chris Marker and his politics, especially in the 60s and 70s, that this is also sort of a kind of like personal elegy, that he seems like kind of a disillusioned communist who is, you know, saddened that this thing that he was really excited could, you know, change the world didn't end up doing that. And yeah, and there's also a lot of other things about, you know.
Yeah, well, it did change the images world.
And,
it just changed the world, just not in the way that he was hoping.
Yeah, right. That's true. Ilya?
Yeah. When we did, or people on Facebook did, the favorite movies since we were born, or they were born lists, I put this on my list on for 93. I had watched this movie a long time ago. I think close to 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And having not watched a lot of Marker movies then, I was pretty floored by the movie. I still really like it. I think that he's a pretty unique guy when it comes to using archival footage, intercutting it with like the way this movie is intercut, and the way he manages to weave a kind of a narrative through it is pretty great. And makes it seem far more than just a collection of like talking heads and like occasional archival footage, which, you know, it kind of is. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I love it quite as much. I think it's a movie that's pretty hard to love, really. It's just really sad. Yeah. And I think he gets a lot of really interesting people to speak. I don't really remember or recall all of their names. I tried to write some of them down, especially the daughter of one of the directors that was killed during the purges was really, really cool. The way she described Vertov was really funny, like him being an idiot and so on. But like everybody in this movie talks, like the way they talk about communism and the way they talk about Medvedkin in that context, I feel like is really worth listening to. I think that this type of perspective is something that really enriches this the conversation about communism and about like what it did to the people that lived under it and what the hopes and dreams of its people were and how that manifested itself in art and how those artists were betrayed by it, but also, you know, managed to create pretty amazing art inspired by it. I feel like it's a pretty complex way of telling history, and I think it's a really good movie.
I don't know if I can say that I watched this movie. It was on, and there were things happening. Every once in a while, there'd be some shots from a Russian movie that I had seen or that maybe I want to see, now that I pop up and pay attention for a minute, and then someone would start talking, and I'd tune out again. So I'm not going to have like anything to say about this movie. I essentially did not watch it, even though I watched it.
Right. Well, I liked this movie. I in particular liked the nuance with which Marker sort of tackled the whole idea of his, like, the filmmaker's place in communism and the way that he was sort of like, he was here for it, but he was also like extremely critical of the government that was supposed to be implementing it and not really properly implementing it. And I thought that was interesting, that the idea that, you know, he's both a purveyor of this ideology, but he's also like critiquing it in his own way. And just his nonconformity. I in particular really like the part where Marker talks about, or it's not Marker talking about, it's one of the older gentlemen in the film talking about the way that bureaucrats look at things and the way that creative people look at things and the way that bureaucrats have that sense of like, not everybody's going to understand this, and, you know, it's not going to make sense to morons. And the artists are like, I'm not making it for morons, I'm making it for smart people. And the bureaucrats like, there's a lot more morons that are going to see it than there are smart people, because there's a lot more morons than there are smart people. And I really liked that like push and pull between like the, like, I guess, practical real world and the, you know, the sort of like high-minded world of art that Medvedkin was coming from, where he was like, hey, you know, I'm an artist and I have a style, but I'm also like in this situation where I'm not exactly sure that I support what I claim to be supporting, so shit's gonna get weird, guys.
I think the other thing that's interesting about that story is that there's a subtext in the way that he words it, because when he says, I'm not making this movie for morons, one of the things that the bureaucrat replies is, we're not quite sure who you're making this movie for.
Yes, that's the quote.
And that's like a really insidious kind of reply, like, we're not sure if this movie is for communists, like, hint, hint. The gulag could be.
Oh boy!
In your future.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, that is a very like insidious spin on what's being said to him.
Yeah, A true bureaucrat would never call the majority of the people stupid or morons. They would always...
Even if they thought it.
Yeah, they would maybe think it, but never say it. They'd rather blame the artists for being something or whatever.
Yeah, not being good enough to reach out to the people.
Yeah.
And their desires.
Or saying that you have to make this movie for the morons. Because that's the people.
Yep. Oh, yeah, I guess I didn't say. I really like this movie a lot, if that wasn't clear from my description of it. I think that while the movie is, like, pretty bland looking in that most of the interviews are just shot with, like, a handy cam, it's, like, very, like, Marker, for the most part, doesn't even try to, like, make them really compelling shots or anything. The way in which it's able to layer, like, again, like, this is sort of Marker shtick, but, like, his personal relationship to what he's doing with, like, a historical relationship with a philosophical one, and, like, kind of like a, like, humanistic philosophical one. There's, like, a interesting part when it's talking about, like, the purges and everything like that, and there's, like, things talking to people whose families were killed, and, like, the thing isn't emphasizing, like, oh, necessarily, like, oh, these people didn't do what they were accused of, although there is some of that, but just the idea that, like, if you're gonna have a revolution of this sort, you're gonna have to kill people, and, like, those people are people, even if you hate them, and that, like, at a certain point, you have to, like, figure out a way to reconcile, like, okay, in order to do what we need to do, we're gonna have to kill these people, but, like, not do it in such a way that you're, like, completely removing their humanity, because that's how you get, like, the Red Terror, where at a certain point human life is so expendable that they're like, nah, if anyone says anything we don't like, you just kill them. Like, there's plenty of people, we just gotta keep going until we reach a point where we can stop killing people. But
yeah, it's hard. There's a part when he's describing the film train that Medvedkin came up with, which was basically his idea of, like, making a makeshift, like, theater production or film production studio in a train, where they would just be able to go out to random places, film things, and immediately, like, have them basically produced and already shown to the people that they were making them for or with. And it's like this very, like, naive, ambitious, optimistic idea of, like, artistry being there for a very practical purpose, while also, and this is what Marker kind of, there's this, like, almost throwaway point there where Medvedkin, who at the time was demoted from being basically a general of propaganda for the Red Army in order to make these movies, he's still like an army officer generally. And when they reach this one area where it seems like a guy is stealing bread, they make a movie about him, and then they shoot him. And he is the guy who basically is in charge of that. And that's just, like, the way, like, Marker's, like, attitude towards Medvedkin is incredibly, you know, warm and so on. He thinks of him, like, there's this, it shines through the whole movie, this big care that he has for him. But at the same time, he kind of, like, this happening, like, side by side, Medvedkin being this, like, quasi-naive, like, artist and everything, but also being, like, a Bolshevik officer, sits really uncomfortably side by side. And I feel like that's one of the moments where the movie doesn't really, like, shine a lot of attention on that fact, but, like, that's what happened, and that's what happened a lot of times. And the uneasiness of these types of very people-oriented ideas and movements and artistry being part of that, and filmmaking being part of that, while also being in the middle of a very destructive force and being part of that destructive force. I feel like that the movie really nails that pretty
it's
hard
very,
a lot of
similar,
times.
Yeah, it's very similar to The Wind Rises in that respect, where you have it's the same sort of thing, where you have somebody who's very devoted to the artistry of what they do, but then you have to take a step back and realize, oh, this artistry is going to be used to murder people, basically.
No.
Yeah, and to that end, also, like, he's creating propaganda on that train. Like, that's what the train is there for. Like, he's basically doing that in order to, like, serve the system that is shooting people. Like, he is, you know, feeding into that greater contradiction within what he believes.
Yeah, and it's a... I mean, it's all a very... I mean, it's a very difficult thing to reconcile, especially... I mean, it seems like something that's very necessary to reach, like, a pretty firm philosophical stance on as, you know, communism is gaining a lot of traction among young people. There's all kinds of memes about the Red Revolution, that's what we want, but it's easy to say that, but then, you know, the very inherent, like, part that goes all the way back to Marx is the way you have a revolution is murder all the rich people, and you gotta line them up and shoot them. And, like, we're all, like, you know, if that's what people want, you gotta make your peace with being willing to do that, and that's, it's a harder thing than it sounds, or at least I hope it is.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
What was I going to say? I think that it's interesting also, like, the way in which it creates a, like, notion about images, like, well, that the images are kind of lies, obviously, because they're propaganda, and that he kind of contradicts previous historical statements that, like, you know, Eisenstein and them, they were, like, creating, like, real art that was kind of, like, reflective of the time, and it was only, like, once Stalin really solidified power that art, like, became such a boring, you know, collectivist, like, not useful, and that Marker's kind of saying, no, it was always really intensely fake and really intensely, you know, propagandistic. Like, there was nothing, you know, the whole idea of, like, talking about Battleship Potemkin and that.
Yeah. It was
the actual
flop.
Right. Yeah. But also not that it was just that it was a huge flop, but also that it didn't happen at all the way the movie depicts it. And there's huge statues that are based on the movie. They're not based on, and same with, like, the storming of the gates or whatever. That picture that's on all the history books is just a picture from
the movie.
Eisenstein's movie, not from.
Yeah.
And, but that it's interesting because then I kind of don't know the next step that Marker doesn't quite get to, or at least only sort of feels like it does, is, like, his movie is also images. And so, like, if part of what he's saying is that images are always, like, inherently propagandistic, like, it's hard to see exactly where he's pulling back to be like, and so is my movie.
Yeah,
he never quite gets there, but he does manage a very funny closing line where he says
about the dinosaurs.
He says today Medvedkin and Zygmunt Vertov would be thought of as dinosaurs, and he's like, but you know what happened to the dinosaurs, kids love them. It's like, he's right. All the kids love communism.
Not me, I
now.
Guess. Yeah. Well, I like communism more than Jurassic Park.
Yeah, he probably was. He probably was commenting on Jurassic Park at that point because it had come out.
Yeah, 1992.
Yep.
You're the dinosaur.
Oh yeah, but one thing that I thought it was really interesting when talking about Vertov and his approach to like life as it is. He wasn't interested in actually like documentary, but he's like life as people experience it. So like his movies try to include like not just seeing an event, but the fact that when we see an event, we're also reflecting on it. So, you know, that like he'll show something happening and then kind of like shift up the angle and like create a thing. And, you know, the actual thing is a document, but everything after that is like staged to create like in the viewer a feeling of,
yeah,
this is what it feels like to see this thing and think about it at the same time you're seeing it.
It's also very repetitive and reflective, the man with the movie camera. Like, it shows scenes, like, it comes back to scenes that it showed earlier, and then, like, sometimes it layers two things that you've seen before over each other. Like, I'm watching a, you know, whatever, like a steam engine chug, but then it's fading over that a person like walking upstairs or whatever, and you're remembering it's like, oh, when you're at work thinking about being back at home walking up those stairs.
Yeah, right. It's pretty cool. So,
yeah, I think it centers Medvedkin interestingly in this, like, because his movies were never really like, he was appreciated among his peers but never really shown much, and very like sadly ironic for a guy who clearly made movies for people. Like, he was definitely like they show him as a director like being very fond of like of animals in his movies, like being fond of like very expression, very strong expressions in his movies, like nudity. Like, there's a really funny scene of this student, this Russian student who had rediscovered like his movies and found a lot of his like film train movies in his archive, and he is telling a story about how he was watching the movie, I think it was Happiness, and there was, and I wrote this down, there was this, there's never been in Soviet cinema such an intensely erotic scene, says
there were
this
boobies in
nerd
it.
And there's this like shot of these two women with crosses and like see-through dresses where you could see their breasts, and like
some
it's just like
you could see some nip,
and like I feel like Marker was not, I don't think he was like being like super snide about it, but when he like cuts back to him to the guy like after showing the scene that he was talking about, and he's like, yeah, that's like, where I knew, that's when I fell in love with his movies.
He was like, yeah,
filmmaker.
I don't know what you just fell like, in love with. You fell in love with,
but that's,
some nips.
But like, I mean, the fun thing kind of about that is that, I mean, the when he filmed that, that was in the late 80s, which was like during Perestroika and so on. Like, this type of imagery was like just getting into like Russian film and cinema and so on again. Like, any type of nudity, really. It was like the,
it's so, like similar to like the Spanish cinema or whatever. After Franco died, like all of a sudden, there's just like a glut of like orgiastic sex movies because they've spent the last like 50 years not being able to make anything like that. All these weird repressed nerds.
The nerds were desperate to see some boobs. They were like, ah, some nipples. Oh my gosh.
So yeah, so he really liked beyond boobies. He really liked cows and like horses.
Yeah, cows
he was
and horses.
Like a cavalryman in the and during the Civil War, which is when he started making these like theater performances, which is also funny. Like, they describe him like making this, I think this play where a bunch of horses were talking at the soldiers that he was performing the play for, and then one of the horses started talking about how it's unfair that this one guy always takes the horse to ride out to his girlfriend, and he had planted actors in the audience that would then say, wait a second, who's your girlfriend? That's my girlfriend. And like would just like really screw with him, which is like, again, like the type of like art that is, or like it's not exactly like super highbrow like theoretical whatever like meta type stuff. It's very like you know, this is supposed to, like, pretty...
It's crowd-pleasing.
Supposed to entertain people, and, like, I feel like what Marker tries to describe is, like, this guy, while being a pretty innovative filmmaker in a lot of ways, was definitely, that was his focus, and the tragedy of his art, I guess, was that it was never really showed to, like, the masses of people that he was trying to entertain, maybe in the first place, but mostly to, like, film nerds and, like, other filmmakers.
I mean, this is, like, this is definitely sort of a Quentin Tarantino situation, because he's, like, making movies that are sort of, like, winking at people who know a lot about film, and he's, like, really, like, in... He's like, hey, are you in on the joke? Like, are you in on what I'm saying here? Like, my message or whatever? And then, like, you know, maybe including the, like you said, like, the 10% to please the censors, but, like, at the same time, still sort of, like, winking at the audience, like, yeah, we gotta put this in, whatever, you know? But, yeah, I thought that was funny that he was, like, such a, like, different kind of filmmaker than you usually run into, where when people are talking about, like, great filmmakers, they're like, oh, they made such movies with depth and beauty and whatever, and here everybody's like, yeah, we love his movies because they're absurd, like, they're kooky, you know, he's just, like, talking horses and people, like, carrying houses around and, you know, all the people wearing these crazy masks and stuff, and it was a very, like, interesting type of, like, filmmaker retrospective sort of thing that I'm used to seeing. Like, I'm usually just like, people are just like, oh yeah, their cinematography was so great, oh, the story's so amazing. Like, you know, if you watch a documentary about, like, Alfred Hitchcock or Stanley Kubrick, it's just a bunch of, you know, filmmakers who will sit there and sort of, like, heap the same sort of praise on the movies, whereas here I think Marker goes the extra mile, where he's heaping praise, but at the same time, like, examining the sort of, like, major stumbling block of this whole guy's career, where it's like, yeah, he made these movies, but nobody got to see them because he was working in a system that actually, like, hated that he was making these movies. So that's kind of fascinating.
While ironically being, like, very pro that system himself, like, being very devoted to that system, and like, being, because of that, never really understanding why, like, that a lot of that couldn't have been shown. I mean, Marker goes, like, to some lengths to show that, like, well, actually, some, like, a lot of your movies, like, you just, like, put a little bit at the end that, like, made it seem like this was, like, a pro-Stalinist movie, but really a lot of the stuff you were showing before was really not that, and like, who are you kidding?
Yeah,
like, especially not Stalin, who apparently watched every single movie ever released during that time, like, personally, which is, like, insane that the guy was, like, so obsessed with film that he watched movies all the time.
Very interested to see Stalin's Letterboxd, honestly.
Well, we're going to be discussing a movie
Volga
of
Volga,
his.
Yeah.
Volga,
no
Volga,
communism.
Which is apparently his favorite
star.
Movie of all
no
time.
No communism. Half star. Yeah.
It's just a shark account.
Thought I saw a red flag good. In the background, waiting, rating pending on confirmation. 1.5 stars.
But then, man. Like, so after, like, he was making these movies that were, like, I mean, Marker shows some of them, and I mean, part of them look pretty amazing. Like the movie where they show, like, this old Moscow being, like, rebuilt, and then, like, then giving way to new Mo- like the
town.
Way. I guess I wasn't quite sure if it was, like, Marker or it was the movie itself that was using, like, rewinding during the
I think
these buildings,
yeah,
like,
I think that's
collapsing
the movie
on top
itself.
Of each other.
Yeah, because I think he says later it was all footage of just, like, one building being torn down, but it was all these different angles on it. And so he was just like, yeah, just, like, reverse the footage in the movie and, like, build the building back up. And but then tore it down again.
Looked pretty cool. But, and then, like, from there, like, basically it shows him to conform basically more and more to what the system kind of wanted him to do. Where at the end he ends up, like, basically being the director of a May Day either a May Day or a October celebration, So basically the biggest like state sponsored event that you had at the time. So it's like, it charts this way of like this guy who, I guess, you know, like maybe he was trying to like fit in really, and at the end kind of like just gave up and like fit in completely. Like at first he was trying to express some of his own views and those of some of his friends that pretty much all got arrested or killed or some other thing happened, and he just like at the end like was like, okay. Because Marker kind of basically waves off his entire post-war oeuvre by saying, mm-hmm. yeah, pretty much everything you did after that was just like a version of these Cuban Cossacks. A movie that was like framed to be like a very patriotic musical. But then like one of the talking heads in the movie says that the guy who made it was like a huge cynic. And like he made that movie because he was like, oh, fuck all these people, I hate them, and like I want to like give them more and more and more of this like fantasy or whatever, which is like really like interesting. How did that guy not get shot?
This, like, he was just like, he just like turned.
Like, was he so good at lying that they never got it? That he was just like all of his movies. Anyway,
sometimes a lot of times like satire will be just taken at face value by people who don't get it, and you know, I don't think that right. it would be a difficult flip to make, where you just like you take the one element that actually makes it satire and just flip it the other way, and suddenly it's not satire anymore. It's just the actual praising of the event, and you know, I think that's also kind of a funny joke if that's actually what he was going for, where he was just like, all right, you know what? Fuck it, I'm gonna give you guys what you want. You want this shit? Here, I'm just gonna like, what? Oh my gosh, there's some sort of like comedy routine where somebody's just like, they're giving somebody something, they're just like, just take it, and they're just like shoving it down their throat. But that's kind of how it seems to me, where he was just like, just take all your, you know, your patriotism and your like face value communism, just take your love of the
system. I guess like. Like, another meta-narrative that's, like, pretty important to this movie is, like, that Marker basically says that, okay, 1917, when the revolution happened, was, like, a pretty huge year for like, that whole era was, like, a huge, pretty huge innovative era for film, and that kind of happened side by side, and that's basically traces the relationship of, like, the development of film and the development of communism, like, at the same time. And what, like, how each, like, reflected on the other. And because all of the film's figures are always put in the context of who they were in the communist system. I feel like that kind of starts from, like, the part where Gorky describes watching a movie for the first time to people who had never watched a movie. So he describes going 1896 to a showing of the Lumiere brothers and describing images on screen to people who had never watched a movie. And his description feels like pretty like, stark or like scary. Like it's not exactly an appraisal of like a new art form or anything like that. But gradually that's what like film became for communism. And Lenin praised film on a number of occasions, very openly declaring it the most important of all art forms. And so I feel like that in itself is like a really interesting topic to analyze, like how the development of Soviet film, but film in general also coincided with the development of communism and how it influenced it in some ways and furthered it.
And that the sort of excitement for both is sort of like mirrored or whatever later in the movie, where it's like, oh, like people were astonished because they'd been living their lives and had never seen a projected image. And then once they had, they're like, whoa, this is something that I didn't know was possible. And there it is. And it's pretty amazing. But now it's so ubiquitous that by the time you've reached any kind of age, unless you grew up in a very in very specific parts of the world. Like, you've seen a lot of images, so there's no way to feel excited about that. And that the way that Marker ties that to the excitement about the possibility of communism, and now the reality of, like, it's kind of like dreary, phony mundanity when it finally collapses, is pretty stark and pretty sad about, kind of bleak about the future of both possibilities.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. We're just, you know, going through our normal mundane recording a podcast on two different continents and four different cities right now, just talking to each other through the magic of the internet.
Really stupid. Who cares?
How get fucking boring.
Talk
to
my friends who are hundreds and thousands of miles away. Jesus.
I mean, that's also like what.
I'm still also here, like, by what, the way, audience.
I guess. Yeah, Ruben's in rapt attention at what we were talking about.
Ruben's had it with the magic of technology.
I don't have anything to say about this movie.
That's fine.
Yeah, the part when you were talking about the train, I was like, he had a half car for processing the film, but then you started talking about something serious, and I was like, I guess I can't jump in with that point now.
Should have cut me off.
Yep. Great point. I was going to say something earlier about when you said Lennon said film was the most important art form, and I was like, yeah, back then, but little did he know the 21st century would have memes.
Yeah, today it's tweets.
That's true.
Really cruel tweets. What was I going to say? Oh, this is kind of doubling back, but it's interesting talking about the mirroring in general, like the way in which when he's talking about Medepkin's movie, because like the idea is that like within the movie there's like a guy showing a movie, but then he starts playing the projector backwards, and that's why the buildings start coming back up instead of going down, and then like the hero of the movie's like, what's going on, and then everyone laughs and he plays the movie the right way, the progress way. But that there is like part of what Marker talks about is embedded within that, the idea that like when a monument comes down, even if you think it stands for something that you don't agree with, like it's still like a part of your culture and a part of your history, and that there is something weird and unsettling and sad about losing it, and the way in which he uses those images and then again later in the movie mirrors them when they're like tearing down the statues of Lenin and like people making jokes with Stalin's face and stuff like that, that they were like, you know, like that's, I don't know, it made me like something about it made me feel really weird and sad about just like history in general, because I was like, oh, like I feel like it seems obvious, but like the amount that we care about different cultures throughout history really just amounts to the endurance of their monuments. Like, we care a lot about Greek and Roman history because
their popular
all their
myths.
Shit's still there. Yeah.
their popular myths and their contributions to the foundations of government and all of that.
but that, like, you know, tearing down all those churches, like, those churches meant a lot to people for a really long time, and that losing them does mean something, in the same way that you can make a joke about Stalin's statue once you tear it down, but
I don't know though to a certain extent, like, then you get into like, well, we have Confederate statues in this country that were, you know, put up sort of feloniously after the fact, that were like a reaction to something that are, you know, they are statues in the you know, aesthetic sense of like that is literally what they are, but they weren't put up in the same way of like, you know, monuments to a specific, they were basically like reactionary things that were put up in the wake of, you know, civil rights being granted to people, and, you know, these after the fact movements and stuff like that.
I agree with that, and I'm not actually saying like don't tear shit down, because, but I think that it is also still important, like, even as we're taking them down, to be like, this means a lot to certain people, racist yeah. people, and it means bad things to them, but it is, like, important to the core of their being, and that, like, we can't actually just, like, ignore it just because we're tearing shit down. Like, it's pretty, it's all muddled. Like, that's one of the things I like about this movie, is that it doesn't actually, like, it asks a lot of different questions and brings up a lot of different things.
Yeah, and,
but it doesn't actually offer any real substantive answers.
I think it's also, like you were saying earlier about...
Very millennial.
yeah. Well, yeah, what you were saying earlier about, like, knowing that the direction you want to go is a system like communism, but also knowing that at a certain point you're going to have to, you know, somebody's going to have to get shot. Like, you're going to have to tread on something that someone loves in order to clear the way, because those old ideas...
You want
to
make an omelet, you got to braid some eggs.
Yeah, yeah. Some of those old ideas deserve to die, you know? Like, some of that old shit deserves to die, and, you know, it's going to have to happen.
Yeah. I've been to Statue Park in Budapest, where they deposited all their statues of Lenin and Stalin after the fall of communism. It's pretty awesome. It's basically like a big dump, except for it's just all statues. And like none of them are like put in any order. It was just, it literally seems like the, you know, they just put it on a backhoe and then just dumped it on the ground. Yeah. And so some of them are like kind of falling over. And some of them are like two statues like right next to each other, like facing each other, like they're about to kiss. Like it's like history
awesome
still exists.
Statues.
30 minutes outside the city. In completely disorganized fashion. And then we got stuck on the bus for some reason. People started singing Les Mis, and I wanted to kill myself.
but yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I don't know. Oh, go ahead.
Ilya. Sorry, to your point earlier, Basil, when you were talking about so the way we kind of frame this movie is almost like it was like mostly incredibly critical of communism in some fashion, but like this movie starts with a shot of this parade going through Russia, where these czarist officers are shown to be gesturing towards the crowd that is watching, like the royal family pass by, and they're like making gestures to their heads. And that gesture is basically supposed to say, take off your hat, you fucking pleb, when you're, like, in the presence of royalty. And, like, I think it's very, you know, it makes sense that this is, like, at the very beginning of this movie. Like, there's no doubt that, you know, Marker and so on frames this not in the sense of, like, oh, this is why communism, like, was a bad idea or anything like that. Like, it shows, like, very precisely, like these were like the people they were combating, and this is like all the great art that came from that, and like these are like the people that lived during that time and had a very complex relationship with what it ended up becoming and the structure that it ended up becoming. But this movie never like comes down hard on the side of like being anti-communist or something like that. Right. I just like wanted to say that because it might have appeared that way from what we were mostly describing about it earlier.
Yeah, he's very careful right in the beginning to be like, oh yeah, like here in the West we want to go, who's responsible for all these atrocities? Is it Stalin? Is it Lenin? To me, not so much. It's this guy. This guy who?
It's this fat guy.
Fat guy telling people to take their hats off, like. Yep.
That's a common story throughout history. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably a myth based on some facts of reality, but that's the story of Purim, the Jewish holiday, about a evil assistant to the king who was trying to discriminate against Jews and told them to all take off their hats when he rode down the street, which, of course, the yarmulkes, they're not actually allowed to take off on the Sabbath, so one didn't, and then he ordered him to be killed, and there was a big revolt based off of that.
Yeah.
And now we make a cookie called a Hamantaschen, which looks like his hat. And we eat it. The best petty revenge of all time. Is what we could use, stupid hat.
I'm gonna eat your head for all time.
I was just thinking of going back to the sort of totalitarian thing, similar to the bureaucrat line. There's another really wry, like, unsettling part when he's talking about, one of the scholar guys is talking about Medvedkin was supposed to get some award, a Stalin award for his films, but that someone accused him of stuff, and he said in Russia, you know, we have the saying, a friend is always watching, and that there's something so unsettling and insidious about that, like, that it's obviously started out as, like, a positive thing. Communism's like, hey, we're all trying to do this communism thing together, so, like, you're gonna help your friend stay on the right track, he's gonna help you, and that's a good thing. But then once it inverts to a kind of totalitarian thing, like the idea that all your friends are actually spies that will sell you out is a horrible way to live.
Actually see almost the exact same growth, same pattern with woke social media, where it started off of people being really supportive of each other and, like, retweeting, like, their smart thoughts. And then, like, as soon as the problematic shit comes out, then suddenly you don't have any friends anymore. You actually have enemies who are ready to betray you in order to get to the top of the heap.
the call-out culture, as it were.
You're just not woke enough. Sorry. We've been talking for a really long time, but we're not friends anymore, and I'm going to make you feel really bad in front of everyone you know.
Always a good way to get people to become better people.
Shame. It really works, you guys. Just shame everyone all the time.
That's why there's all those great stories and movies about, like, people growing up in, like, really like right-leaning Christian environments, just growing up to be, like, solid adults with, like, no real trauma, like, or anything.
a really faulty, I guess, way of comparing that, of continuing that metaphor, would be to say that the people who then end up, like, admitting on social media that they did something wrong and, like, really, like, having, like, their PR person or whoever, like, write their apology for them, kind of similar to the people who, like, admitted to being, like, Japanese spies under interrogation, like, whatever, like, when they were decried as, like, enemies of the people. It's like, or what Vertov ended up having to do is basically crying on a podium and admitting to being a cosmopolitan, which is the greatest crime of all.
That section's pretty interesting.
I realized it didn't make any sense.
Yeah, this sort of thing that
I was thinking
she,
in metropolitan, not cosmopolitan.
Yeah,
yep.
Cosmopolis.
I like that drink,
Cosmopolis.
Yeah.
That it's interesting. Her depiction of Vertov was that he was so, he was so committed to his way of thinking that he wasn't, like, clever enough to play along with, which is, like, that's, like, the real sin of his work, was that, you know, the other filmmakers who got to keep making movies, they found a way to balance things, or as Medvedkin ended up doing, just sort of sell out completely for the sake of continuing to make movies. Because it would be very frustrating, I'm sure, to, like, come up with an idea for a movie, do all this work, write the script and everything like that, and be like, look at this movie, here it is, it's ready. And then they're just like, no, sorry.
Yeah.
Or make the movie and then be like,
shot.
We're just not going to show it.
The part that I thought was funny, before you ever finish it.
Yeah.
Where it shows the movie that he was about to make before they shut him down after he made Happiness. It was the movie where it was basically just a bunch of people. I forget what they were called. There was some sort of, like, oppressed group apparently in Russia, and they like get to hell and they're just like, oh, well, this isn't as bad as what was happening to us when we were in Russia getting oppressed.
No, those were actually just like working class people. Yeah, like he just showed like mujiki, which means just like men, like working men.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, we're in hell. Actually, this is fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is pretty cool.
I was
cool
like, that's a hilarious idea
right here
for the movie. They're like, yeah, this is good. It's like that meme of the dog sitting in the fire. It's just like, this is fine. That's it.
It's like,
man, this guy was ahead of his time.
Hell is communist Russia.
Yeah.
Oh, Sartre.
There's also another pretty unsettling part that's like a common thing throughout whatever, but when they talk about the movie that was made about like the I forget what the exact event was, but it was like some real event, and then in this town, and the people in the town, like, it wasn't nearly as romantic or exciting, but the people in the town loved the movie. Like, they loved watching a fairy tale of their lives more than
that's Cuban Cossacks. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's basically just the life of like people in that area, which was an incredibly rural, poor area where nothing fun or especially exciting ever got to happen. And they made like a musical there. And that was the guy who then later said, I despise all these people, and I wanted to make a movie about like how, you know, like how they really wanted to be seen and so on. And like that was the part where I'm like, God, this guy is like, fuck me. Like, I wish they'd shot him. Right. Like, really, why didn't they like fucking put this guy against the wall? Like, Jesus.
But it's also interesting the sort of like. I mean, that he points to kind of systemic issues also, the sort of famine or whatever. It's very obvious, like, that it seems obvious now, but at the time it seemed like factories are the best. They're the most efficient way to do anything. You just turn a farm into a factory and boom, you're going to have even more food. And the answer was no, you got less food. You got a bunch of people standing around fallow fields or, waiting for crops and 40 people working a land that would usually take one.
And, man.
Really, really fucked over Ukraine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also liked the discussion about the tractor metaphor. That was pretty funny. Mm-hmm. Like that one metaphor that every Russian movie apparently used where a tractor breaks down and like... the method that is used to get the tractor started again basically like is a metaphor for, you know, the way to fix problems in society or whatever.
Well, how cool was the part where Stalin got the tractor to work?
Stalin just like, drove that tractor just the spark plug
all the way to the Red Square, and like Stalin casually strolling through the Red Square is like, this is how you fix
it. How you fix that. Or the one where the woman like tears her skirt and it's like
ever the practical guy.
Like, ooh. She's like, don't sully the flag. Let me tear my skirt off and give it to you. Like, it's like, this is goofy.
And then
his was where the tractor just goes out of control and runs over everybody. That was pretty funny.
But like, actually, like, speaking of that part, like, that part of the movie was like when Stalin was played by one of the actors that usually depicted him, this guy called Chiorelli, Georgian actor / director. Who talked about like him being scared of Stalin because he was like incredibly paranoid about him and liked to apparently watch him go to the toilet and whatever, or like was like he felt his eyes like staring at him even when he went there. But like the other parts in this movie describe like people shooting footage of people like Stalin or people from the NKVD, like the top guys from the NKVD or later KGB. And how those people like got shot or they got like arrested or whatever. And one of the people in this movie, who's a cameraman, describes like the feeling he felt when he accidentally filmed Stalin. Like they were shooting some part, and then like Stalin appeared in the frame, and he like ran away because he was so scared that they would find him with that footage. And that's like he stopped being a cameraman after that. Mm-hmm. Like that is. Yeah, there's something about like a party or a government that is so obsessed with film and depiction of film, and that is so incredible, like thinks that them being filmed is tantamount to like a death sentence to whoever does that. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, something there.
The weird, interesting, I mean, aspect of like that for a lot of people, because of the proliferation of film over lots of other kinds of media, like tons of people that live their whole life never seeing a real picture of Stalin. They just thought of Stalin as the people,
the actor
who played him.
I thought that was kind of funny too. Like he basically was Stalin because this is what all the people saw him. Mm-hmm.
Just like with the battle scenes that they described earlier, right? Like that people mostly knew them from as images from movies rather than like actual photos or anything like that.
It's true. And I mean, I guess the only last thing that I have to say is just about that sort of like interesting way in which like the elegy part plays out, that like at a certain point everyone obviously knew like, oh, the USSR isn't going to be what we thought, and it's probably never going to like embody the ideals that it started with, but that like the way that Marker frames it is like while it was still around, there was like the hope, there was always like this glimmer of hope that like, oh, like for people like him, for Marxists or whatever, it's like, oh, maybe that communist utopia is still possible. And that it seems very sincere that Marker was like profoundly saddened by perestroika and everything like that, because it's like the death of that utopic dream for real, like that once it all ends, you can't be like, the USSR is going to do it, because it's not there anymore.
Well, there's the weird framing that he uses, that basically he talks about the history up to the end of the Second World War, or like maybe up to the death of Stalin, and then he fast forwards to 1990, basically. Yeah. That's when, so he basically skips the entire history of the Soviet Union all the way down to there, and after the Second World War, Medvedkin never really made another movie worth a shit, and like, boom, and then he was dead. Like, he went to Paris, we met, that was cool, and then that was it. That's obviously a very pretty, whiplash way of, like, describing history. And, like, there's a part of me, when I was watching the end, like, so when he's, like, showing, like, scenes in Russia in the 90s when people are, like, fighting each other in the street, like, regular people just standing in line for stuff and, like, yelling and screaming and like grabbing each other, which is like a horrible time, obviously, but like that, you know, that part was going on during the late 80s as well. Sure. That was not a uniquely like post-Soviet phenomenon, and like there, a part of me is like, yeah, like there's some part of this that's like this whiny like non-Russian way of looking at communism as something that was like, oh man, like I really wish it would have worked better. But then like all these fucking people and their stupid, like, you know, like stupid way of like acting towards each other and like being like miserable, like that, like why did that have to happen? Like fuck's sake, man, you can't have one without the other. Like, you either take this like as a full history, like with all of it resulting from something, and not just like, oh, and then like the stupid like 90s thing happened, and then like Russia was like the awful Russia that we know of as today. And like, nah, man, like fuck no. That part really kind of made me mad. And I don't think it was really designed to feel that way, but some of it kind of did. And that's what generally like makes me really mad when people start talking about like that period in history in general. Like, it's it's much more complicated than, oh, people were just like really fed up with the Soviet Union, and then they like immediately became like these capitalist vultures that were ready to eat each other alive or whatever. Like,
I mean, obviously, consolidation of power was there the whole time. The people never really had it. They just were told that they did. But I did like the part of that, like, weird montage where the first part of it starts with, like, five different people in a row trying to film somebody and then them slamming the camera out of their hand or, like, knocking it down. And I was like, oh, this is kind of cool.
Cause the death, like, of film.
Yeah, exactly.
Equals the death of communism.
Right. And a culture that was initially, raised on the beauty and potency of images and how truthful they are, becoming like a culture that's like so distrustful of image making that they're like, fuck you can't film me, and just knock it out of your hand. Pretty cool.
That's well put.
But I don't have anything else to say really, but
do y'all think that images are actually that powerful?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
Patrick says yes.
Part of it has to do with, I guess, sort of the... I don't know, like... I don't know what you would call it necessarily, like the cultural potency of the medium itself. Because at the time, it was basically like the newest, hottest thing. And I think that that definitely plays a role where it's like... the penetration of the message itself goes like further and longer than other things just because of the, like, I guess the reach that the novelty itself of the message medium has. So I don't know if you'd get the same mileage out of, you know, making a movie or, you know, even like a documentary about something that happened today. You know, as we've seen, like, you know, there's documentaries about social, you know, events and movements all the time now, and the market seems to have been flooded on that, so I don't think that they have the same potency now, but I do still think that, you know, in a given medium, depending on how much cultural impact that medium has at the time, I definitely do think that there's a lot of power in images.
Yeah, I think, I mean, any one image doesn't necessarily have a lot of power, but
that's where I was about to go. That I don't think that, like, if someone says, like, I'm going to make a film and that film is going to meaningfully change things in the world, they're deluding themselves amount of power that the individual has. But I think that when certain types of images reach a tipping point, that they become normalized, and that normalization for sure affects the culture.
Yeah.
But that I don't know if the power is in the image itself in a way. I guess the power is in this society consuming it, and therefore, and that's the thing that we don't really know where it comes from or how to control it. I mean, I guess some people have a better sense of it than others, but for the most part, our smartest critics of it are not great at, like, predicting trends, but, you know, or someone like Adam Curtis, who can look back at history and be like, this is what images have done over the last 30 years, but
they can't. There's no way to
see the future,
project into the future.
Yeah, and they don't know how to fight the situation that we're at in order to make it better or how they would want it to be.
Do you think images even exist outside of this way of, like, cultural consumption right now? I don't think there really are any that exist outside of that. So basically, every time you're dealing with an image, you're almost instantly dealing with that phenomenon of proliferation, right? Like, Like, there's almost no, like, there's the most images that you encounter are images that are distributed by media that are consumed by millions of people, right? So,
But I feel like, I don't know, like, if we were to keep the eating metaphor going, I guess, like, you can consume some things and your body will turn it into something, and you can consume some things and your body doesn't really turn it into anything. It just sort of passes through your system, and we don't really know, like, what causes, like, certain things to, like, catch on. And I guess if you're removing intentionality in that way and being like, oh, this thing was, like, zeitgeisty, and then that sort of changed how we look at men or relationships or people of color or violence or the media or whatever, like, the fact that it was unpredictive and then sort of, like, unconsciously accepted, like, is it the image that's powerful, or is there just something inside people that they're reacting to, and then that causes major societal shifts?
Yeah, a lot of the times the things that'll hit the hardest are things that are confirming an idea that's already been out there in the ether somewhere that, like, people have gotten a whiff of but haven't, you know, I guess, like, fully figured out a way to make it concrete. And then they'll see, you know, a piece of media that actually, like, comes up with a, you know, gives you, like, a shorthand for it, and they immediately gobble that up because they're just like, oh, finally, this, I've got a, you know, something to attach that loose thread that's been hanging, that's been bothering me this whole time. And it's like, ah, now things seem so much clearer because I've seen that. You know, I feel that happens to me a lot with like ideas about social issues a lot of the times, where I'm like, I know this is bad, but I can't quite put into words why. And then I'll read something that someone has wrote about it, and I'm like, aha, that's exactly what I was trying to say, but I couldn't vocalize it. You know, or even like when talking about movies, like that long thread on the list that I made about white people solving racism, where I was like, I was trying to come up with my defense of Django Unchained and why it wasn't a white savior narrative, and I couldn't quite do it. And then Ruben wrote this long defense, and I was like, that's it. He just articulated it perfectly, and I couldn't come up with the words for some reason. But that, like, that's the same thing, where it's like somebody just, you know, comes up with a way of articulating an idea that's already floating around in people's heads, you know. But again, like, how do you know when the idea is floating around in people's heads? And, you know,
we're getting into real Jungian territory now.
Yeah, it's hard to know.
Yeah. Talking about
that collective unconscious
archetype.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, but at the same time, I guess, even, like, to bring it back to this movie just for one sec, like the way, like, the development of film in the Soviet era is, like, described is, like, as if that was, like, so, like, every person in the Soviet Union watched, like, Ziga Vertov's movie or whatever. Like, that was not true. Like, most people didn't.
Yeah.
Like, the meaning of those movies towards that ideology is definitely, like, looking back, that seems like an awfully nice, like, fit of, like, this incredibly strong aesthetic development coinciding with this incredibly strong ideological development. But whether or not it really had this profound an impact in terms of the imagery that it conveyed and how that influenced the people around it is really questionable.
Yeah. Even Battleship,
I'm not sure that it really was.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way to look at history, but I'm not sure whether or not the impact that it had was really that great, you know. But I think about the impact that, like, images that Stalin controlled and put out into society and distributed, and that people had in their homes, like his portrait or his books or certain, like, the imagery on, like, books that were distributed in schools or whatever. Like, that was probably the imagery that most influenced people, like, at that time, because that was the imagery that was most distributed, right? These movies were kind of in a vacuum of their own, almost.
Yeah. It's hard to know, like, just what is pervasive, I guess, in people's brains.
Are you saying we're not going to figure out these extremely complex issues on our podcast?
Do I? Yeah. We're going to solve it, people. We won't quit podcasting until we've solved. No. That shit's tough, man. I don't know what to say.
That shit's tough. That's a good way to end this.
Do svidaniya.
All right.
Very good. Thanks. Very good Russian on this podcast today.
That one I learned from the classic film. I believe it was Fair Game, starring one of the Baldwins.
Steven Seagal?
Crawford?
Cindy Crawford?
Yeah, yeah, right.
Billy Baldwin? Is that Billy Baldwin?
And it's like how they find out that it's like the Russian mob or ex-KGB or something, or the bad guys, is that they like write "Do svidaniya" on the bullets. So, it's pretty awesome.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Screenwriter.
Just like those Russians to be so symbolic with their imagery.
I hope they paid that screenwriter a lot of money. Come up with that shit.
I'm sure they did. let me look up what's next so people know what I won't be watching next time, but that they can. I think it's mine, but it might not be. It might be.
I think it's The Dawn's Here or Quiet.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's Patrick's pick next. The Dawn's Woo! Here or Quiet is our next one being released. Although, I think actually before that, we're going to be doing a new film, Blade Runner 2049. So, check out both of those.
Depending on when I can catch it in the U.S. Yes.
For our next podcast. And if you're enjoying the podcast, you can subscribe on your podcast listening application. And of course, you can always check out all of our content on loosecannons.net, writings, videos, and our other podcasts. Thank you for listening. Oh, also check out our message board. It's a link on the website. Join in the conversation. If you have any questions or comments, email us at loosecannonspodcast@gmail.com.
.net.
Thanks for listening.
Spicy bye.
Gmail.com.
Bye. Yeah.
Wait a second. It's loosecannons.net. Oh, but yeah.
Yeah. loosecannonspodcast@gmail.com. Privyet. No, wait. That's the opposite of what's happening.
Yeah.
I think we nailed it. Yeah.